When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to Foundation and Podcast, the officially unofficial podcast for Foundation on Apple TV+. I'm Jim.
I'm Aaron.
And today we're talking Season 2, Episode 2, titled A Glimpse of Darkness. Aaron, what'd you think of this episode?
It's another good episode of Foundation. There's a couple things I'm not clear on, and I'm not sure if that's because they haven't fully fleshed out the rules, the things I'm not clear on. In particular, I'm still not sure where they're going with the way that the Gale and Salvor can psychically project themselves forward and backwards in time. And if, like, are they telling me that one has the power to do one has the power to do the other? They both can do that, and they just haven't trained for it. But, like, I'm kind of still patchy on how that works. And but otherwise, and also I feel like I'm a little confused by the Harry situation and his consciousness and how long he was imprisoned in the Raven in the Prime Meridian. No, Prime Radiant.
Yeah.
The Prime Meridian. He's stuck in Greenwich Mean Time. Just, it's the horror. But otherwise, yeah, like the show is, I'm really into the Klingon stuff, the Empire stuff. I think the Dominion Empire tense standoff is fascinating,
and the mystery about who hired the assassin I think is getting real interesting.
That
now
was interesting, because the way Empire was talking, the branches of Empire last week, is that she had engineered that catastrophe to put herself on the throne. That's not the opinion I got from her this episode.
A lot of just long looks in this episode that I'm like, how am I supposed to read that? Because there are several ways I could look into that.
And it's fascinating the way that the Foundation is consciously morphing itself into a religion, and how that seems to, like, even though they know they're doing it as kind of like a bit, that they're also can't help but quite get lost in the bit a bit. And I think that's really interesting, and, you know, tracks along with the stuff that they do at the Foundation in the book. So I'm a pretty happy camper in this episode. What about you?
Yeah, absolutely. All the things you said apply to my watches as well. And, man, I'm really enjoying the first two episodes of this. I look forward to seeing the next one. I haven't seen ahead of this one, so yeah, I'm going to be able to do all the theory crafting and stuff that I like to do about this show. So, yeah, we'll see. There's a lot of stuff that, even though I've read the first book, it's been a couple of years now, you know, since I read the first book about 2 months before the show came out. So I'm starting to forget things, like this Hopper Mallow that he's screaming at the end. Is this a character that was in number one, one of the several dignitaries that Harden interacts with? Or is this a character I don't know yet?
Yeah. And I can't help you with that, because I've read these books even longer ago than you have. Read them all. And I could say some things, but probably nothing helpful. So,
well, I'm excited to not know, frankly.
Who is Hober Mallow is certainly a burning question on everyone's mind at the end of this episode. It's burning. It's a burning question literally on the vault.
Yeah, it's definitely on the warden's burning mind.
Yeah, you you give a warden a fish. He eats for the night. He teach a warden to fish. He eats the rest of his life, and he set a warden on fire, and he'll be warm for the rest of his life. I think that's Harry's philosophy.
Totally. So I feel like we should just get right into it, unless you got other stuff to talk about.
Nah, let's get into it. All things have a cycle. First the podcast, then the ad.
We're getting geared up for the 6th annual Summer Badass Fest. And while we're working on a slate of apex badass films to enjoy, we've got an early action-packed announcement to make.
Just like last year, we're kicking off Badass Season with a live movie watch and podcast recording. We've rented out a theater for connoisseurs of action films and Bald Move fans that just want to have a great time.
Unlike last year, this year's movie is top secret. Hush, hush. No hints, except it's incredibly badass. It stars an absolute icon of the genre. We're willing to bet most of you haven't seen it, and it's going to be an incredible viewing experience with a packed house of Bald Movers.
Those of you who came to last year's screening of Total Recall know what a party it was. And those of you who didn't, now's your chance to experience it. Meet me and Jim, order some custom movie-themed drinks at the theater's full bar, then watch us record the full podcast for the movie. We reserved a venue over twice the size as last year, but seating is still limited.
It's happening Friday, June 21st at 7 p.m. in our hometown of Cincinnati. Get full details and buy tickets at baldmove.com/live.
Cincinnati's actually a pretty great city to visit, and we've got lots of details for side adventures on our event page as well. The Reds are playing the Boston Red Sox in their fantastic Riverside Stadium. The thrills of Kings Island just minutes away, and I'll be leading a kayak trip down the scenic Little Miami River on Saturday.
Again, get full details and get your tickets now on our Badass Fest 6 page at baldmove.com/live. Here are the highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
Our coverage of Hot D, Fire and Blood, and the 1980s Shogun miniseries continues. But then on Tuesday, for the first time in 35 years, we asked a question. Who framed Roger Rabbit? Hop aboard the train to Toontown as we revisit this incredible blending of live action and animation to see if it still holds up all this time later.
Then on Wednesday, we get our first look at Blake Crouch's mind-bending sci-fi series, Dark Matter. First two episodes drop simultaneously on Apple TV Plus, and we'll have a pair of podcasts quantumly linked ready for you to observe.
You can find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app. Math is never just numbers, and this isn't just a podcast. We're back with more Foundation.
All right, we start off on Synax, where, you know, the hurricane was coming from last episode. Pick up right there. Harry, before he's going to help them, has a bone to pick with Gale for leaving him stranded for so long. And they kind of talk about this. And then Salvor's like, hey, you have to get us off this planet. Otherwise, your second foundation is going to die on the vine. So he fixes the engine, but there are some things he can't fix. One of the stabilizer is stuck open, and Salvor has to go out and clear it before they take off.
It's all barnacled up.
Yeah, I kind of like that detail. All the seaweed that's hanging off of it, the barnacles sucked onto the hull there. Yeah. Makes sense after 138 years. Honestly, I don't know if they put enough barnacles on this thing.
That's what I was thinking, and also like watching Salvor punch those barnacles off, like, oh boy.
Fist.
Yeah, it's just going to be chunks of hamburger left after that, because I don't know if you've ever fucked around with any piers in the water. Those things are sharp as fuck, man.
Mm-hmm.
Hard, oh, yeah. like razor sharp clamshells.
Harder than knuckle skin, at least my knuckle skin.
But I honestly could not tell you what Harry exactly is going on about at the beginning of this episode, because he's screaming about, what did you think would happen when we severed my conscience from the Raven? Did you think I'd sleep like you slept in cryo sleep? And I'm like, because I thought Gale said in the last episode that I put him in the Prime Radiant the night before while you slept. And we even talked about this last week. Like, is she referring poetically to the long sleep that Salvor had done before she got there to wake her up? Is she referring to, because like last night, like I don't see, if she transferred from last night, I'm thinking that's a 24-hour period. And then, so are they implying that like a
there's
day
some time
in
dilation.
The prime radiance
no.
that's going so, it's going so fast that like he's been in there forever?
No, or... I figured this out because I was definitely confused the way you were. And I spent like 20 minutes going back and watching old parts of the episode and like looking at the details. And what he's talking about here is the time that he spent in the knife, because she grabs the knife off the Raven as she's getting into her pod. And so he's conscious within the knife for 138 years. And then she puts him into the Prime Radiant from the knife in that night.
So he
before.
Was already losing his mind when he got thrust into the Prime.
Yes. And the Prime Radiant, you know, is the system that coached him through putting his mind back together a little bit, or at least enough, right?
I wonder if when we're seeing him screaming at himself in black and white, if that's him in the knife, and then when he wakes up into the giant, confusing 3D terrain, that's when he's been turned into the Prime Radiant. Why did she move him from the knife to the Radiant in the first place?
I don't know. Why not just leave him in the knife?
She's worried the knife's running out of battery.
Sure. Okay. I couldn't tell you, but that's the deal.
So he did spend... a good long time from a human perspective trapped in some kind of machine hell, I have no mouth but I must scream type situation. Okay.
Alone with his own thoughts, and you know that's a dangerous thing. Like he said last season, someone stuck in the vault for 50 years might go insane. Well, how about in a knife for 138?
Yeah, it's a lot. Mm-hmm. He also dropped this, which I don't think that we knew, that Ra's knew, according to Harry, everything.
Okay.
Yeah. Which is interesting because Ra's is the one that kind of like, I get it. It seems like what they're getting at is like no one accounted for Gale's psychic ability.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, she wasn't supposed to interfere with the Harry Seldon murder. Certainly wasn't supposed to interrupt, and Ra's just had to improvise.
Yeah.
Because, like, you know, if you can blame anyone from fucking up the plan, I guess you could blame Ra's for taking the plan and saying, nope, forget it. I want my, sweetheart to survive, and that's that.
Uh-huh. Yeah, okay. He's definitely the most to blame. But, you know, understandably so.
I liked that Harry has this kind of throwaway comment where he realizes that Salvor's talking about the version of him that's on Terminus, and he, I guess for our benefit, says, oh, that's the other one. You don't know his mind. He doesn't know yours.
Is that for our benefit, or is that supposed to make us ask questions? Because for a moment, he thinks he is on Terminus. Is that just temporary insanity, or is this some kind
of
link
one of those things where
two?
Like sometimes you see this, like they did this a bit with Invincible last season, where they had this super villain that's a clone of themselves, and when they wake up they're convinced that they are the original.
Sure.
Because like from their perspective
they
have a continuity of consciousness, and it's like, you know, and they get like really pissed off if you suggest that they're not. I wonder if that's like he wakes up and he makes it, but like he could have been the guy in Terminus, because I think it's the same consciousness. But my suspect—I mean, I don't know—they play this in science fiction a lot. My suspicion is they're going to diverge pretty rapidly based on the experiences they're having, especially one of them staying conscious for 138 years, losing a grip on reality, and getting prime radianted. Yeah. He's going to be a lot different than the character. But it's also interesting that the vault opens up and fucking burns a dude, just sets a motherfucker on fire, like. I don't know. Maybe that Harry's had some hard times inside there, too.
It could be. Could be.
Or maybe he's really not a fan of this magician shit.
Yeah, we'll find out hopefully next episode. Because that vault, you know, it's open, but it's, well, we might not. You might need to find Hobermallow, and that's going to be a whole journey, I imagine. So I don't think Harry's coming out until they get that Hobermallow guy.
I do think this is kind of review, I believe, because didn't we have an inkling? I can't remember if this was something that was established last season, the second Foundation's purpose. We know because they were heading to Star's Inn that they were going to, you know, that Harry's plan was to do a second foundation, but I'm not sure if he like illuminated what that, but now we kind of can talk, because that's one of the big twists of the foundation, that there is a super secret second foundation of psycho historians that in clandestine, you got the primary foundation's a lightning rod that's going to take all the attention, and you know, their successes and failures, they're going to need to be managed. Empire's going to be managed. You have to have someone that can account for the slight uncertainties within the psycho history. So his idea is a second foundation that knows everything, but also is hidden from human view, so they can't interfere with the psycho history predictions, putting its thumb, like he says, on the scale.
Yeah, guiding them sort of down the right path. Which, I mean, this... To me, this opens up the sort of nesting doll, like foundations all the way down sort of concept. Who watches the Watchers, that kind of thing. If power has that potential to corrupt, and they're worried about with that with the first foundation, why would they not be worried about that with the second, more powerful in the grand scheme of things, foundation?
That's a great question.
Third foundation.
Is there a secret third? Yeah.
Yeah.
But it's got a second foundation. Like, if the first foundation is, I keep forgetting that I've read this entire series, and even me making jokes might subtly be influenced by the stuff I know about. So, never mind. There's two foundations, as far as we know. And the second foundation was to keep the first foundation from getting too big for its britches and to account for other types of drift that we see. We see the bright red inflection points that are way off course. Since that never happened, we're now at a crisis point where the whole plan seems like it's hinged to be dashed to pieces.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, one other thing, character point. Like, Gale gives Salvor a big hearty hug at the end of the scene.
Yes.
Like, their relationship is beginning. It's not mother-daughter, but they're actually bonding.
Uh-huh. Yep, and we'll see more of that, I presume. So now we go over to Savannah in the Outer Reach, where a girl is out riding on a creature, and she sees something and goes back and wakes up a drunk cleric and tells him, "I found a death threat in the form of a guy tied to a tree. Apparently he was killed by worshippers of the lightning god." And he says, "Well, they'll be coming after us later, so let's be prepared."
This is a fantastic location. I'm always impressed when they, like, you know, in season 4 of The Expanse, where they can find a place on Earth that just looks like it's alien. And this didn't look CG. Maybe hats off to the Foundation team if it is, but, like, they found a fucking alien landscape to put this CGI monster on. Do you remember what these things are called?
No.
These are the Bishop's Claw that threatened the early colonists of Terminus. Now they're riding them as beast of burden, which is a cool showing, like, how utterly masters of their environment that they've become. I like this. I instantly like these two characters.
Me too.
There's
a kind of a funny, subtle joke here where she's, you know, they're down at the lake or whatever drinking, and she's scooping up water, said, "Let's bring some of this back for the cleric." Mm-hmm. And then when she gets back, she finds him passed out in a stupor, and she dumps it on his head.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that's how she meant to bring it back for him, but it was pretty funny.
Or it might have been. That'd be funny if that's kind of the routine.
This is a common occurrence that he's incapacitated.
Yeah, and we'll come to appreciate in this episode that this is Polly from last season.
Right.
This is the 10-year-old kid that was enamored of the vault, and, you know, they had that competition. They tried to get as close as they can, and he succumbed to the null field. Salvor had to go rescue him. And they posit that he is the last living survivor from Foundation, the Foundation that remembers the last appearance of Harry Seldon.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that was a really cool detail.
And they do some world building here. They talk about how the Empire uprooted from this planet and left these people with nothing. And now, you know, they have this lightning god they worship, because you can see in some of the establishing shots of the planet, just lightning storms constantly across the surface of this planet.
Yeah, and it's cool to see, you know, we've heard about Empire receding and how they are withdrawing from the outer reaches of the galaxy, but now we see it that, like, yeah, the Empire's just pulling up stakes and rolling back. They're in full retreat.
I do wonder why, because the Outer Reach has been dark. It's not like the Outer Reach has been pressing in, taking these planets. The Empire has just been pulling back, and I don't necessarily understand why the Empire is intentionally shrinking itself. If it's a logistic problem, or
yeah,
if there's some other threat.
Right there. The amount of logistics that's required to control area is like probably inversely proportionate to the, you know, amount of area you're trying to control. Mm-hmm. So it's like it probably gets harder and harder. And so, like, if you are, you know, feeling vulnerable, you're having attacks, people are trying to nibble away at your edges, it's probably better to pull back and consolidate, rather than just, you know, be stretched so thin that you can't respond to anything. But it's telling us that this is definitely an empire that's in decline, not just
totally
genetically, but in terms of resources, in terms of military might.
And I guess you got to remember back to, you know, season one, where there's a lot of people who don't like the rule of the Empire. And it's not like there's some massive force that is threatening the Empire. It's just all these micro threats, right? These micro fissures in the Empire are getting bigger because Empire themselves are unable to keep their shit tight, you know?
Yeah, it's like a death from a thousand paper cuts type of deal.
Yeah, and pretty significant too. I was listening to the official podcast, and Goyer was talking about how it's gone from something like 10,000 planets to 6,000 or 7,000, which
is a significant decline.
Yeah, that's something that everybody would notice.
Yeah,
it wouldn't really be rumors. Almost, it would just be de facto, like, the Empire is in decline. Look at it.
But on the other hand, would the core of the Empire know? Like,
they might not.
If especially because we know from the first season that the Empire controlled 100% of the propaganda, like. Uh-huh. Everything that went out in the news services was something Empire directly controlled. So it could be that at the warm glowing heart of the Empire around Trantor and in the Galactic Center that, like, yep, a lot of maybe people are ignorant of how far Empire has fallen. But clearly it's not a complete mystery, because that's Dominion's hitting him pretty hard with some facts.
Yeah. Yeah, and she might be a lot more in the know than most people. But yeah, this whole thing they're doing here with these magicians, I think, is kind of interesting. I like the way it's reshaping the Foundation, but we'll get to a lot of that stuff later.
Yeah.
Trantor. Empire is admiring the paintings of the pre-Kleonic Empire. Dimmerzell tells him that Dawn and Dusk had no memories of hiring the assassins, but that's not necessarily a guarantee they didn't do it. She's going to continue looking into it. And she also suggests someone who Empire apparently hates, Bel Rios. He go after Foundation, to engage the Foundation. He reluctantly agrees and instructs her, if he refuses this job, kill him.
This is fascinating, because you'll remember that Foundation was based on Asimov reimagining the rise and fall of the Roman Empire. That was kind of like this big histography that was popular at the time. And, you know, if you know anything about Roman history, it's replete with generals that have loyalty to their legions and politicians, leaning on those figures. And it usually doesn't go. Mm-hmm. Doesn't always, you know, you got Cincinnatus, an example of a guy who did the thing and then gave up all of his powers and relinquished control. But then you've also got guys like Julius Caesar cast and die and kicking ass and disbanding senates. And so it's like it's interesting to see, you know, we got a weakened politician here with a general that says, you know, like the Elder Dusk is saying, oh, he commands the loyalty of a lot of his fleets. And You just got to wonder, is this not a decision that Empire likes? Is this something that he feels like he's being forced in? And, like, what are the repercussions going to be as this plays out?
Yeah, I'm excited to see that. That's one of the, I guess, paths of attack here on Empire, because there are so many that I... And specifically Day. it's wild, I guess, how much he's changed and how much he's trying to change Empire in his brief tenure. But I guess that's his right as the active arm.
Yeah, what did he call himself? The primary? I forget the...
Yeah, I can't remember the term.
They had a term of art for, like, you know, which the main Empire unit. But I like how they started where he's, like, looking at this painting from the, like you said, pre-Cleonic dynasty, and he's talking about how... Because in the first season, Empire is just so grand and so untouchable and so magnificent. And here he's talking about this pre-Cleonic dynasty that was 4,000 years ago and lasted for 2,000 years, which is more than his empire has lasted so far, and had four times the area and oversaw a blossoming of science and culture. And you can clearly see that he's thinking, I'm over a declining empire, which is not flourishing for shit. And what does that say about me? What does that say about us? Mm-hmm. You know, the capital U. But also, he's super fucking arrogant and ego driven. And
oh, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm still definitely unconvinced that this is a good idea. I know your empire is crumbling and you're taking a big swing here, but is this the right swing to take? I don't know. Probably not, but we'll see. The other thing I noticed in this scene is the very end of it, after Day has walked out of the room, Demerzel takes a long, hard look at this Empress. And I read a lot of meaning into that. I'm wondering if... there's two ways you can go with this, right? If you go with the righteous, just wants to protect the Empire... Demerzel, you could say she's worried about the return to this, you know, this pre-Cleonic empire. How can she avoid it? All that stuff. Or she could be looking at this thing saying, I see a lot in common with myself in this Empress. Boy, it would be cool to be Empress one day. Think there's anything to that?
I think, yes. I was more...
Is this worry or ambition in her eyes here?
Or is it like an opportunity? She's like, you know, I've taken this Cleon thing. Because, like, we've had this theory that, like, Demerzel is the true thing that maintains the Empire.
Mm-hmm.
But we also know Demerzel's been around a hell of a lot longer than even this Empress. So the question is, like, how long has she been enmeshed within the inner workings of the Galactic Empire? And is she thinking, is this a fork in the road? Where it's like, well, I've ridden this Cleon, literally in recent times. I've ridden this Cleon horse as long as I can. Maybe it's time to do a different tack, and I need to start supporting something different. Or is she thinking, I've got to put a stop to this? And I'm genuinely curious to see, you know, are we starting to see the ends of the Cleonic dynasty? And by the end of the season, it's going to be done, and we're going to have something else that's replaced it, or chaos, or I don't know. But you're right. She is definitely thinking big thoughts at the end of the scene.
Oh yeah. And there are a couple other times where she gives some ominous looks, but we'll talk about those. So the Cleons discuss Belrios as they practice their intricate synchronization of eating as if they were a single person in prep for a meal with Day's wife-to-be, Queen Sereth. Day gets annoyed and then storms off. He hates this stuff.
It's funny because they throw out this Syntamorgan, which I thought was just some made up science fiction foundation term. Do you know that's a real scientific term?
No, what is it?
A Syntamorgan is a unit of measure for the frequency of genetic recombination. One Syntamorgan is equal to a 1% chance that two markers on a chromosome will become separated from one another due to a recombination event during meiosis, which occurs during the formation of the egg and sperm cells. On average, one Syntamorgan corresponds to roughly 100 million or 1 million base pairs in the human genome. So it's kind of like a way that you could measure genetic drift, or like how far apart
probability of genetic drift, maybe.
Yeah, that a chromosomes become separated and didn't recombine correctly. And it might, I'm not sure if this is being used correctly or if they've repurposed it 10,000 years into the future, because it kind of, the way they used it, it felt like Han talking about running the Kessel Run in so many parsecs, and it's like, is that a but again, I don't, but I just thought it was really cool that they're actually using a real term that measures some kind of genetic admiralities, and they're talking about he's off by 3 centimorgans, and apparently they've repaired that DNA, but the effortless coordination that they used to have, and the snapping of the napkins and the taking drinks, and like, they're still doing it, but the effort it's requiring is so much more than it used to be. They got a whole body coach that's like looking and making sure they're doing everything the Cleon way. And you can tell this is really grinding Day's gears.
Yeah, it's this and the needling about the marriage and stuff, about him changing the empire, right?
But even at a base level, it used to be effortless. Like, it didn't feel like I'm trying to pretend to be someone. I was that person. And you can tell that, like, it is starting to get to Day that, like, I'm putting forward this enormous amount of effort to pretend to be someone else that I'm not. And I just want, I want off.
Yeah, that's the thing. It used to be all on Day, or all on Dawn, rather. The newbie, right? Like, he's got to learn to be like us, because we've already learned all this stuff. We already know we are that person. Now it's kind of, Day is the real aberration here. Day feels like uniquely drifted from this, even though his DNA has been repaired.
Mentally, I was about to say that, because you notice that, like, when Day storms off, like, Dawn and Dusk are in perfect synchronization, just the way they drop their head and they put their hands in their lap.
And
last year it was Dawn. This time it's Day. This season, Day is the weirdo.
And that's dangerous, because he has the power. You know, it's one thing for Dawn to do that.
Because we've seen Dusk huff and puff a lot, and they do have a certain amount of power. But, like, at the end of the day, we've never actually tested, you know, like, Demerzel has been the one that's, like, solved a big dispute between Day and Dusk. But, like, yeah, what powers does Dusk and Dawn have to, like, gainsay what Day wants to do?
Especially if he wants to.
And like, especially if Day's doing something like, hey, I'm going to end the dynasty. This is it. It's going to be me. I'm the last one. Fuck you, Dusk. Especially fuck you, Dawn.
Yeah, because Dusk, you've had all this power before.
Right.
You're on your way out anyway.
All
Dawn,
you got to look forward
up.
To is the disintegration chamber, you know?
Right,
like,
right. And your
paintings. Dawn's never going to get it.
No. Which makes me think, you know, Dawn has the most incentive, I would think, to hire these assassins, but there's no telling whether it's him, someone we've met, someone we haven't met. Still a lot of season to go. So,
and we've never seen it. Have we ever seen a highly competent Dawn? Because I think that's what we're getting this season. Like, this guy seems like he's a student of history, and he's, you know, because he tries to flash out this, like, oh, you know, I was reading and I found out this other time where we had a charismatic general and it caused problems for this, and like, Dave's just not having it. But I don't know. I thought Dawn seemed pretty well-read and thoughtful, and and the, like you said, Day's the problem. Bottom line,
for sure. So we go back to Salvor, who asks Gale why she refused to start the second foundation, and she tells her all about Raish. Then Harry comes in and tells them about the purpose of the second foundation, which is to keep the first foundation in line while guiding the galaxy to its Dark Age soft landing. Gale tells Harry about her visions, which she thinks are her future memories. They're 150 years in the future, and Harry thinks she should try and go into them to find a new path forward. Or, I guess, a path back onto the real path.
Yeah, this is where, like, I just have to go with what the show is telling me, because I don't exactly, you know, this is, I've never seen stuff like this in science fiction before. It's pretty, like, I kind of think,
fantasy-based.
Yeah, I definitely kind of, it's not even fantasy, because like in Star Trek they have telepaths and, you know, people have some kind of clairvoyant powers, and it's always explained, it's not like magic, it's just something that we don't, you know, it's just something about subspace vibrations and the fifth dimensional points of view that we just can't quite comprehend as humans yet. And that's one of these situations where it's like, I think what they're going is that, like, Gale and Salver are going to realize that their powers are one and the same, and Gale is going to be able to project forward as and backwards, and they're both going to be able to do this and develop this power. But yeah, I don't want to say too much because, again, I have read the whole series and I don't have the particulars, but I do have the broad strokes, and I'm trying to squint and see how they're trying to smooth some of the transitions, because, you know, Asimov wrote this all kind of serialized, and he was, you know, making it up a lot as it goes, and it changes quite a bit from the beginning to the end. So it could be that they're trying to smooth over some of the stuff. But yeah, apparently, I mean, some of the stuff makes sense, like, you know, Gale or Salver can bring her back, and she knows this because Hugo used to be able to call to her and bring her out of her, you know, delving into her memories and her future past. But yeah, like, I'm just going with the show at this point.
Yeah, conceptually, I'm much more interested in the second Foundation and their purpose.
Yeah.
And how, you know, Harry has thought that will go versus how it definitely could go. I don't know. It seems like a concept that is doomed to fail on the face of it. If just applying the same logic to the second Foundation as you would the first Foundation says that the second Foundation needs a third, and on and on and on. So we'll see
the full plan, and we still don't. But it's like, I remember, like, when I was reading this as a much younger man, like, just how cool the first book or two are, where it's like there's so many plans and counter plans, and I also really liked, it's a fun part where, you know, Salver starts to object. It's like, you don't know the Foundation, they're great people and they would never turn into the Empire. And he just looks and says, everyone that you knew and the Foundation is dead.
Yep.
Which isn't actually strictly true. We find out with Polly.
Very close to true. Yeah.
But is that... So that's the thing. Is like, sometimes the show, it's like, did Harry, like, misspeak? Or is this... Or is this a deliberate thing that the show's doing to show that, like, even Harry, his conscience doesn't know everything? And this is something that we should... Because, like, yeah, he confessed that everyone that you knew is dead. That's not strictly speaking true. Polly's still kicking. So, like, if he's wrong about that thing that he surmises, what other things can he be wrong about?
Especially because it's an assumption, right? Based on reasonable probability. Everyone should probably be dead in 138 years, right?
Yeah, but even with the modern medicine and whatever, like, that kind of gives us an idea of the lifespans we're talking about today. But yeah. Yeah.
So if that's not 100% reliable, how much of the path is 100% reliable?
Yeah, agreed.
Uh-oh, our dynastic empire is experiencing some genetic drift. We'll be right back.
Here are the weekly highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
Apple TV is releasing a new series based on Blake Crouch's novel Dark Matter. Aaron and I are big fans of his work, so we're picking up the new show on day one. Join us this Wednesday for the preview podcast.
The Shogun Limited series might be over, but that doesn't mean our Shogun coverage has to end. We've got the wrap-up podcast releasing this Tuesday, where we'll consider all your feedback and final thoughts on the series. And because we like the show so much, we decided to go all the way back to 1980 to cover the first TV adaptation of the novel. Do what you can to find a copy and join us this Thursday for the first of our four-part podcast on the 1980 Shogun miniseries.
And finally, the latest first-run movie, The Fall Guy, features Emily Blunt and Ryan Gosling. He's a stuntman tasked with finding the star of his ex-girlfriend's movie when he suddenly goes missing. Is it a rom-com? Yes. Does that mean I'll automatically hate it? Not if the trailer lives up to its promise. Join us for the podcast on Bald Move Pulp this Thursday night.
You can find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app. Hey, it's time for another season of Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? The premise is simple. A Gen Xer and a millennial watch old 80s action TV to see what still works and what doesn't. In previous seasons, we've done podcasts for Knight Rider, Airwolf, MacGyver, A-Team, and more. However, this year we're doing a very special season of Feeny. We're going back and reviewing the very special episodes of 80s and 90s sitcoms. Come cringe along with us as Hollywood tries to warn our families of the dangers of underage smoking, drug abuse, alcoholism, eating disorders, and much more. We start out with the episode of Boy Meets World where a high school kid gets sucked into a cult. Worlds collide as the Mr. Feeny finally makes an appearance on Why Is Mr. Feeny a Car? Join me and my buddy Jay each week for episodes full of nostalgia and secondhand embarrassment. And don't worry, a very special isn't your speed. We've also got some all-time classic Knight Rider episodes to close the season with. Find Why Is Mr. Feeny a Car? Each Wednesday on Bald Move Pulp, starting April 3rd.
The algorithm says this podcast will continue. Welcome back to Foundation.
Okay, then we go back to Empire, where the meal with Queen Sarith begins. She asks some very probing questions about cloning and the dynasty, and then she asks to actually see the clones, and Day escorts her there. I'm going to stop here for a second, because there's a lot going on in this scene. She's... Boy, I could not relate more with Rue, who says, you know, jokingly, but I think very pointedly, if she's not careful, she'll talk herself out of this marriage. Like, shut the hell up. What are you doing? You know, this is not how you behave in front of the person we're trying to impress here. And I'm actually still not certain why Day is not a little more dismayed by everything going on here.
Is he just
I know
dumb?
He wants this. I know this is like his life's mission. But yeah, he seems a little
he
seems arrogant. He seems like he in this scene he's being offended left and right, but he never wants to admit that he's offended. He wants to act like he expects this, like he has, you know, accounted for all of it, and that nothing here is out of the ordinary and she can't possibly flap him.
Yeah, he's trying to go through the motions of being the old Empire, where like we were so grand and magnificent that we don't even notice the slings and arrows and the bites of the gnats. We don't even care. Like he's trying mm-hmm. to, you know, even though he's lost 20, 30, 40% of his territory, and she's letting on that she knows more and more and more about. And even saying she knows, she's heard of the rumors of the genetic dynasty and,
mm-hmm.
you know.
And then the scene where she goes to the Principium with him is even more interesting. That there's elements of her testing her boundaries here with
yeah.
Day. There's elements of her testing her leverage, seeing just how much she has in this situation. And Day just handing her all of this information with his reactions. It's a really yeah. well-written scene. I love this stuff.
And her probing, too. Like, oh, Demerzel, she's not dining with us. Of course, she must have, you know, she must have some chamber of Demerzels, too. Else, how would you explain? And like, Cleon's, oh, yeah, she's got other arrangements. She's like, she gives me the impression that she knows. She's like a good lawyer. She's not going to ask a question she doesn't know the answer to already.
Yeah.
So, like, when she's answering these questions, I think that Dominion is very well-informed.
Mm-hmm.
And you got to understand, it's like now to the point, it's like, why is Dominion here? Why did Dominion accept this offer from the imp? Like, what is she? And if she's already this cheeky about, like, you know, thumbing her nose at Empire, like when they actually start negotiating a sharing of power, seems like she's in a position to wrest some real concessions from him.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think this is her establishing the balance of power between them prior to agreeing to anything, because she's pushing boundaries so far that I don't know that this empire is equipped to claw them back later.
And there's also a lot of things, like, you know, we talked about the mystery of like who killed her family, and she talks about, they're talking about having children. It's like, yeah, I suppose, and if that's a more sure line of succession than what he's got with the Prince Atorium. And she's like, suppose with enough children, even an uplink crash wouldn't disrupt the line. And then Empire gets real quiet, and she yeah. mentions that my sister was trained to be a stateswoman and a mm-hmm. diplomat and, you know, an economic, and my brother was a military genius who led our expeditionary fleets. And I, you know, I was so unimportant. I was just allowed to be a Liberty Gibbet. I was just a dilettante. And it's, interesting. So like, does this make it like where are you at on whether on whether she engineered this death in her family? Is she the dilettante? Is she the ingenue that organized and is behind all of this, manipulated this? Or is she saying to us as the audience that I shouldn't be the empress, I shouldn't be dominion, but I am, and it's dangerous to underestimate me?
Interesting.
Because this loss has made me cautious.
I hadn't considered that. I think that's definitely a possibility. She seems, like you said, much more well-informed and much more adept at this than just, I don't know. I mean, she's a socialite. She probably reads people well. She probably knows where she can, you know, push and where she can't. And I think there's a lot of skill that comes with being who she has been that would transfer pretty well to this scenario.
And she's fearless, and it works whether you believe that she killed her entire family to take power or that she's had everything taken from her and she has nothing less to lose. She's either wildly ambitious or, you know, or like single-minded in like some kind of revenge plot or some kind of like, you know, is she essentially like Prince Oberyn from Game of Thrones, where like, I'm just here to find out who murdered my sister and her kids and kill those, and then I can fuck off and go back to where? Or is she
maybe
more like a Tywin, where it's like, I actually killed all the kids and I've, I want to make sure I'm the one on the throne? Like,
I mean, that's certainly interesting. I think the other thing that's happening here is, you know, Cleon has just said, well, we can assure. We can have a certain amount of assurity by just having a lot of children. And then she points out that she was one of three children. Now she's one of one children. That's not nearly as stable as you might think it is, you know, just having a bunch of children. But in the same breath, she's also describing the Cleonic dynasty, I think. There are three of them.
Yeah.
And granted, they have clone backups, but they're
right.
What she's saying is there is no real amount of assurity that you can have. You shouldn't be so secure in the idea that you can just be cloning yourself, because I mean, you take a bomb to that Prince Zippian, you take a bomb to the three brothers, and that's it.
I like how she also the phrase assassination by procreation. You know, like she's going to, like, this marriage can do what so many people have tried and could not, which is destroy the Cleonic dynasty.
Like, and specifically,
as sure as a bomb
Dawn,
through the Prince of Praetorium is.
You know, we talked a little bit about Dawn, and specifically Dawn, and I can't help but notice in this scene, she's really leaning into Dawn. She's, you know, putting her hand on his arm. She is paying a lot of close attention to Dawn. And I don't know if that is her trying to figure out, you know, the assassination attempt. Was it Dawn? Can I glean something here in this meal? Or if she maybe doesn't have aspirations to be with Day, but she wants Dawn and they can together?
Interesting.
Rule? Because that would be a much longer rule. I don't know.
Yeah, I got it when I was watching this. I got from that she was noticing, you know, because she's saying like, hey, well, how do you guys you're the branches being lopped off that we're speaking of. How do you feel about it? How do you feel about it? And with Dawn maybe seeing, because I think they're closer to like their age.
Yeah,
like just like, you know, like it seems like she's half Lee Pace's age,
and she's a third child, so probably younger. Yeah.
There's a lot like of in common. We've all, when you know, historically, when we look at the first season, Dawn's always the weak point. It seems like that's a common vector of attack. So, makes sense.
Yeah. And then let's go down into the Principian here, because this gets way more interesting. Dawn shows Sereth Cleon the First and his own backup clones, and explains how the whole process works. She tries to confirm that the rumors about the clone corruption are true, but Day doesn't exactly confirm it. He doesn't say anything, although the look on his face says, shit, she knows too much. Here's the other affront. The one that she points out to him is an affront. She quotes this poem at him that has been banned across the empire and is a crime to recite from. And she recites it to his face and points out that I just committed a crime in front of you.
And what's funny is
And he doesn't even know. Like, this is a law that he himself passed a generation or two ago, and he has no idea, which kind of gives you an idea of, like, how... And there's this really rapid-fire, crackly dialogue where, you know, she says, you know, like, she asks, will these assassins, like, tell me about this attack. And he's like, yeah, we put him down, and there was a ruthless display of justice. She goes, do you think the assassins will be deterred? And she goes, we at Dominion, we don't try to deter. We ask why there's unrest and then attack the root causes. And he goes, well, your hand is a lot lighter in Dominion than we have in the Empire. She's like, well, a well-trimmed vessel requires a light hand. And he's like, Dominion is small, Empire shrinking. Man. They just go back and forth like that. And it ends up almost getting him to spill the beans about the genetic drift. And he goes, well, that would explain.
Is Empire strong?
Yeah, that would explain your interest in my unexploited womb. It's a great scene.
Absolutely. Yeah, the dialogue is great. The setting is great. I really love going down into these clone chambers.
And she's this very teasing because she's like, are you expecting us to have intercourse? And he's like, oh, well, you know, we've got the genetic scientist. And I forgot the Empire is sterile genetically, that they can't have children. So there's a way that they can reverse that. And they've already tested the genetics and they're very compatible. And
yeah, they were testing the genetics in real time here. He got her DNA off the glass she was drinking from.
Yeah.
It's cool. So let's move on to the next scene. We've talked a lot about this one, where Brother Constant is this girl's name who was writing this creature earlier on. Brother Constant walks into a town on Savannah to put on a show and preach to them. Some of the locals start hassling her, telling her to leave, take her foundation propaganda elsewhere, and they chase her, try to attack her, but then the high cleric shows up and dazzles them with a light and magic show while preaching the good news of Harry Seldon. And they get an alert and they're called away.
I really liked when she looks up at the cloud. You might have missed it, but like, there's a cloak ship. Like, you just see the vague outline of a ship in this cloud. And she's like, you know, clearly they have a routine worked out where she works the crowd, gets them all worked up, and then he comes in with a razzle-dazzle light and technic show.
These are people who believe in lightning gods, and so they kind of give them that flavor, right? They pretend to be gods. He comes down in this shaft of light from an unknown source. He's shooting off fireworks and creating crazy images, essentially stuff that's magic, and yet what he's preaching here is science. And I think that's really interesting.
Yeah, and they're showing some cracks. Like, you know, they're suggesting that, like, the Foundation's been able to be very successful spreading with this kind of religious, like, the instead of, like, trying to wean people off of their superstitions, is lean into it, you know, do like a Roman thing where it's like, oh, your god does this. Oh, actually, let's help you to understand that your god is actually our god.
Yeah,
you know,
we got one of those too.
your three gods are our god, just in a trench coat, you know, and a pair of fake nose and glasses. But like, it seems like the locals are starting to wise up. Like, they're not as intimidated by this magician. Like, they're like, you know, they're cowed briefly when she has the shield, but then they try to gang. They're like, well, we know how to disrupt this. And they just gang up on her and wear the shield down. And she drops one of her trinkets, and they very conspicuously show an old man from the village look at it thoughtfully. And I wonder if they're suggesting that the Foundation is maintaining their, you know, kind of sway over these places by solving their problems, but keeping them proprietary. Now, like, maybe this magical technology that gives them this power is going to be owned by the masses. And now what, you know, what do you do? I don't know if that's what they're going for, but that's what I was thinking when they showed her drop that bracelet and the old man pick it up.
Yeah. Makes a lot of sense. That crowd, man, they're fickle too. Like,
yeah,
that you get them chanting one moment, cheering the next. So,
yeah. But, I mean, it's also like, that would be a hell of a performance if you saw, as an agrarian society, some man descend from a shaft of light and shoot fire out of a sense and summon the galactic spirit and say he can cure your crops dying and he can drive pests from the village. It's you talk shit to him, he picks you up and throws you into a water tank. So... but it's also wild to know that this is the Foundation. This is the thing that Harry Seldon founded of reason and intellect, and they're charlatans.
And it's
it's crazy because, you know, we haven't seen Foundation in 138 years. This is our first glimpse of it in that period. And you start to wonder, like, what has Foundation become? If this is the forward-facing Foundation, what is it? And 138 years is a long time for something to change, an organization
like
this.
Four or five generations, yeah.
Yeah, there could be a lot of drift. And I think they do that very smartly, and I think later in the episode when we see that this is essentially just recruitment, it starts to make... It layers on. You know, I talked about Terminus and Empire and everything being kind of characters in their own right. And that, to me, is part of, you know, what makes that an interesting layered character is the different things we find out about them.
Yeah.
So let's, I guess, go to the next part of the scene. The vault has apparently opened and they've been called back to Terminus. The second coming of Selden means the second crisis, which worries this high cleric, and they head back. But he's also, you know, his faith has wavered a bit. And I can't really say I blame him. He saw Harry as a kid, and that was amazing, and that carried him through the first 100 years of faith. But you get past the centennial mark, and you start to think, is this guy ever coming back? I thought he was here to guide us. I thought he was going to help us.
Yeah, and the fact that, like, you know, when he comes, he's kind of a prophet of doom. It's like it's one of those scary, exciting things. Like, oh, my God, this is happening. But also, oh, my God, this is happening.
Yeah.
And we also see how they've solved the lack of spacers. They just punch in an autopilot course and slap some patches and go to sleep. And I thought, you know, because I every time I finish one of these episodes watching two or three, you know, I've watched up to four. I put a list of like all the open questions and I'm like, you know, your whole crew passes out during your jump trip. That seems very exploitable.
Mm hmm.
If you are a military force that has spacers that can stay awake during hyperspace jumps, that seems crazy exploitable. But we'll see. We'll see if any of that comes to pass.
Yeah, definitely. But I thought it was like super interesting, the technology, because this is all Invictus based, right? It's just that they've found a way to nullify the deleterious effects, I guess.
Yeah, you don't need an active navigator anymore. They've got some kind of computational base, and then so they just all they haven't mastered the art of, oh, hyperspace travel fucks you up physiologically, and
sure,
they sleep through. It's just they don't need to have anybody awake.
Uh-huh.
Not even the Empire has that technology, because they rely on the spacers, the specially genetically engineered humans that withstand the stresses of interdimensional travel. So
yeah,
they're actually more advanced than the Empire at this point.
Yeah, in some ways. It'll be interesting to see if they develop travel faster than light travel that they don't have to go to sleep for eventually. Because
that would be truly advantageous.
Yeah. Anyway, Salvor decides that Gail needs to try listening for her voice in her memory so she won't get lost in it. And she tries to enter her future memories here, but it's not working. So she decides to kill herself. Literally, she removes all the air from this compartment and passes out, and then she ends up in her memory, is chased by someone she's going to refer to here in a bit as the Mule. He grabs her and demands to know where the second Foundation is, and then she hears Salvor's voice and returns to the present to tell them what she experienced. The Mule's afraid of the second Foundation, and she's got this location of where she knows the second Foundation is from the memory. It's a place called Ignis. And they look that up.
Yeah, I thought it was kind of cool that, like, in the... oh, shoot, what's their planet name?
Synex,
yeah. That the word prophecy is, like, means water takes them. So they've got this kind of, like, drowning... going into this altered state so they can do these prophetic trances, and she uses the fire suppression system to do that. We get hit fast and furious with a bunch of words we've probably never heard of. This mule guy picks her up and wants to know where her mentalics are.
Uh-huh.
And wants to... can look into her mind and see that there's a younger version riding a shotgun within her mind, which is kind of wild, and ask if she's from the Age of Empire, which implies that we're post-imperial in this timeline.
Mm-hmm.
shouts out Hober Mallow, who, boy, he's the most wanted. They're the most wanted person in the galaxy, in the future, in the present. The vault's asking about him. The mule's asking about him. What the hell?
Uh-huh.
And the other thing, the thing that I thought was the wildest is that there's a hand mark.
Yes.
I don't know if this is the Foundation people just kind of like playing fast and loose with like metaphor, because like I can't figure out how that could possibly have worked. It's like in the Matrix, like your brain makes it real. Like how
sure,
do you
form bruises and
yeah? How do you
was,
put thumbprints on people's
grabbing her neck as she was in this memory and squeezing?
Maybe.
But it surprises Salvor.
Salvor. Yeah. But it could work if she grabbed her own neck. You could if you grabbed your neck so hard it left bruises, I might still be like, God damn, Jim, your neck.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What are you doing? Maybe. But I don't know, barring that, it does seem like there is some physical connection to the memory she's in, which is wild.
Here's a connection I came up with. I couldn't help but notice Brother Constance has these most arresting blue eyes. They're supernaturally blue. When the mule took his goggles off, I couldn't help but notice he had very similar glowing White Walker eyes.
Yeah, very blue eyes. You're saying Brother Constant becomes
Hugo? Wasn't that like a that was one of the Anacreons this is the Thespians were the ones that had the blue eyes.
Thespians, yeah.
The Thespians, not Thespians. The actors. The Thespians. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure. I see there's a connection here, but I'm not sure exactly what they're trying to say.
Yeah,
are they trying to say this is a...
don't have enough information yet?
Yeah, like, are they, like... yeah, like, what are they trying to say here?
They're hinting at something.
Yeah. Yeah.
I legitimately don't know. Haven't read that far ahead, so...
Wasn't it not a theory that we had that maybe Hugo, that maybe Salvor is pregnant with Hugo's child? Because that would be an interesting connection if, like, Brother Constance is a descendant of Salvor and Hugo, the same way that Salvor is descendant of Raish and Gale, and then the mule would also be related, and the fact that he's got some kind of mental powers. I wonder if they're trying to imply there is some kind of actual relation.
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe maybe the psychic, that's some kind of signal that they have psychic powers.
It's the longest gestation period ever. 138 years.
No, I'm not saying I'm saying that she might be the grandchild of, like, you know, like the descendants of Salvor and Hugo.
No. I mean, if Salvor is pregnant, that's the longest gestation ever, right?
But she's been in a cryo chamber.
Uh huh. I know. Oh, but 140 years later,
yeah.
A child is born to of Hugo's. Yeah. Like, how do you track that in the family tree, right?
That's like what 2,000 trimesters.
What's this 140 year gap? Right.
That's a long, yeah. I carried you in my...
For 140... Boy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Is
Gale going to drown in every episode? Because this is number two, and she's drowned twice.
Right, yeah. Maybe.
That would be kind of funny.
So Ignis, the star system, or as planet, literally means fire in Latin. Relates to fiery things. I wonder if that's going to, you know, when
there's
we get there,
of
if that's
fire
actually
in her visions.
That's going to be important.
Yeah, could be. Super interested to know more about Mentalix and Hober Mallow, but obviously,
and both Salvor and Gale get this kind of sight when they see this planet. They feel called to it. There's something that's like that's vibrating, that they feel like this is the right path. I wonder if that's. I wonder if that is something they can trust, you know?
Yeah, we'll see. It's also conspicuous that, like, there's a delay in Gale detecting it, whereas Salvor feels it right away. Has to say, you feel that, you hear that, right? And she says no, and, well, listen.
Yeah,
Yeah, I wonder if you, if you think about the way the future versus the past works, if there's something to that. I feel, like I said, I feel like there's a whole lot they're telling us in these scenes that is going to be clear maybe later on.
Yeah, I think you're right. So then Brother Constant reunites with a friend who is worried about war. They're on Terminus, and the High Cleric goes to a planning meeting for greeting Harry from the vault, and there's a lot of contention on who should greet him. We also find out that the director is Brother Constant's father. It's sets up some tension there.
Yeah, so like, does she have two dads? Because when she greets this one man right off the shuttle and calls him Pater, which is, I think, whatever language they're speaking for father.
Oh, really? Then, I assumed it was just his name.
Oh, maybe it is.
Peter,
I thought it was some kind of version of like Padre or Pater. Because I think there is one language that Pater is father.
Maybe. I don't know. They struck me more as like lovers or very close friends, something like that.
See, I thought they were suggesting that maybe she could have two fathers and they maybe have some other way to... But anyway, I thought... And that guy's clear as... I mean, maybe he's her uncle or something. But yeah, clearly, you know, the mayor is also... Or the director is also her father. Or is her father for sure.
Yeah, yeah. She's calling him father specifically. I thought it was interesting to see the state of the Foundation, you know? This is the second glimpse we get of it. And it shows us that, oh, it's not just a religious organization that goes out and evangelizes. There's a whole military wing of it. There's whole...
Yep.
I guess we saw that briefly in the last episode. We saw that there was a warden. But they've got this religious angle, which is for recruitment. We know they've been told by Harry they're going to go to war with the Empire. I honestly am not sure about the High Cleric's critiques here. I think he feels marginalized and feels like they've abandoned Harry's mission, but Harry specifically came out of the vault and said, "We're going to war with the Empire, get ready."
Mm-hmm.
And that seems to be what the director has done. I mean, preparing
spoiling
yourself militarily,
yeah,
that's what you should be doing in the 138 years,
yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm. And there's
so what is his objection to military base, like setting up military bases on other planets? That seems right on.
Are we talking about Polly?
Uh-huh.
Because Polly seems like, that's what I'm saying. I was going to talk about like the fact that there's political factions, like that, yeah. You know, everyone's kind of singing from the same hymnal when it comes to like outward facing things. But internal, like Polly was not a fan of turning everything into religion. And he thinks that this is a perversion. Oh. But he also in the same breath will say, "I'm the High Cleric and I should be the one talking to the like you can see that like these like, you know, and sometimes we're taught as children, like, the words don't mean anything, sticks and stones, break our bones, blah, blah, blah. But, like, words actually do have a lot of power, and it does shape the way we think about things. Mm-hmm. And I think they're trying to tell the story of, like, the Foundation saying, oh, ho, ho, we're going to do this magic and this religion as a way to, like, you know, appeal to the masses. But that decision over the course of a few generations is drifting dangerously to where they're believing it.
Yeah, like, why wouldn't they? I mean...
Yeah. And yeah, especially now that there's the Polly, the head one, is like kind of in on the joke. But if he die, if he has an overdose tomorrow, whatever he's shooting up or, you know, drinking, like that's the last, he might be the only thing keeping the Foundation even kind of sort of secular.
I get super strong Scientology vibes from all this. Like there's the religious like Xenu Thetan bullshit angle.
Right.
And then behind that mask, there's people who want to make a lot of money and take advantage of their power.
Yeah.
That's what
and
it
I
feels
like.
I
like that when they talk about the prophet and Polly says, "Which way are you spelling that?" You know?
Uh-huh.
Yeah. It's a great fucking line.
Uh-huh.
And Polly's disappointment of being sidelined. Like, we're using you for your political power, but we're cutting you out of the... You're the only person that saw and talked to Seldon or Harry last time, but fuck you. And then also, like, the fact that this marshal or warden guy doesn't even do the thing he said he's going to do. Like, you know, doesn't even... Son of a bitch didn't even introduce me.
Nope.
I thought that was interesting. The fact the Foundation is, as we saw in the first season, somewhat divided about which way it should go.
Yeah, and there's a lot of, you know, with that profit line, there's a lot of insinuation about personal gain versus, you know, just supporting the Foundation itself.
Yeah.
And I don't feel like we've gotten a great taste of that yet. I don't see the director as necessarily being out for his own gain. Yeah, maybe this office looks like Terminus a little bit, or it looks like Trantor a little bit, but also, look, you need a place to meet. You need this kind of stuff. I don't know what the other people's houses look like, you know? Maybe it's all paved in gold. Mm. So I'm looking forward to seeing more of that, I guess. The
sure.
Personal versus, you know, for the Foundation kind of thing. Anyway, everybody goes out to the vault. And the warden gives a speech about how awesome it is that he gets to be the one to greet Harry. And then his body is lifted into the air and charred to a cinder as he shouts, "Hobermallow, bring me, get Hobermallow." And nobody has any idea who he's talking about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I like how like everybody's like, who? Because I was like, yeah, who is this Hobermallow? And the show wants us to be thinking about it. But it's so funny the way Polly is so petty about this, because he's like, when, you know, this guy says, "I will lead you whither the prophet leads us." And he's like, "This fucking chode saying whither. He didn't even introduce me." And then he gets lifted in the air and everybody thinks this is like, you can see the warden starting to believe like, oh, I've been chosen by the prophet. And then he fucking burst into flames in the most painful way possible. I don't know why. I don't know, because I kind of like when I was watching it, I don't know, something about this warden made me think that he's just this massive dick. I have no reason to believe that, you know. This drunken old man has convinced me with like three words that this guy's evil, to the fact that I'm like, yeah, burn, motherfucker. He did. I don't know if he did anything wrong. Mm-hmm. But that's the other thing. It's like, yeah, what the hell is Harry doing in there? Why is he burning random people?
I don't know, man.
Like, if you want to talk to this Hober guy, just come out and be like, I want to talk to this Hober guy. I'll wait while you're finding him. Why does he got to fucking burn this dude alive?
Mm-hmm. And clearly, the warden's experiencing some kind of visions during this. You know, I don't think he knows Hobermallow either. So no. Harry's doing something to this guy beyond just burning him alive. He's using him as a mouthpiece.
Yeah. Yeah, it'll be... But also, you know, Harry might be thinking, well, if they're expecting a vengeful god, then I'll give him a fucking vengeful god.
Yeah, maybe he is trying to establish himself more as a god than
maybe
a
if the second
figure.
Because that's the question, is like, maybe if the second Foundation is around, maybe they're behind the religious curve. Like, Harry's like, you guys are still pretending. You should be true believers by now. But that's a wildly different Harry than the one that wanted to kill himself before he got too big of a religious following. But it's all timing and nudging and tweaking when it comes to psychohistory, isn't it?
Let me ask you this. Is it possible that the second Foundation Harry is worried about the first Foundation Harry being the guy who the power is going to go to his head? Could this be a flash of that? Not the people in the Foundation, but Harry himself at that Foundation.
If you're suggesting that there is like a struggle for Harry supremacy, Seldon supremacy, I don't know, but that's a fucking great concept. If the two artificial copies of Harry Seldon start coming up with the doctrinal war, I would fucking love that. That would be pretty cool to explore.
I agree. The other thing I like about this is, you see the Black Vault turn into this kind of scaffolding, this golden scaffolding, golden framework that we saw last season. Mm-hmm. And if you notice, the pendants around the cleric's necks are all the shape of that, right?
Of course, yeah.
Yeah, the shape of the open vault, not the closed vault.
Mm-hmm.
Then in the final scene here, we see Salvor wake to find Gale worrying that they're making a huge mistake. And she says, "That's because I saw your dead body in my vision." And then we've got to wonder, you know, is this a vision that can be avoided? Is this a certain vision of the future? Can they be on a different path and still be on a good path? Who knows?
you know, we joked in the preview coverage about like how are they going to keep, because it's, you know, you could keep Klingon around. You know, we talked about last season, like, you know, by third season, fourth season, or is Lee Pace going to have like a Quasimodo hunchback and three eyes and two toes, you know, six toes on each foot? Like, what's going to look? But like, we're like, well, what are we going to do with Gale and Salvor? Are they just going to like jump in a cryopod at the end of each season? But like, I think this episode itself raised that possibility, because Gale's like, how am I going to project myself 100 years into the future? I'll be dead. And he's like, well, you slept through one century. What? I'm like, yeah. Holy shit. And then Gale, and then Salvor's there too. They're 100% going to get into a cryopod, because they don't even, well, I guess Gale, it could be some kind of residual self-image bullshit. But yeah, Salvor's laying there on the ground, does not look appreciably older. Like, maybe she's 5-10 years older, but she doesn't look like she's in even middle-aged. So it's going to be a plot point that these guys are going to jump into another cryo chamber.
I love it. End of every season, get them in the cryopod. Gale drowns every episode.
Yep. Yeah, Harry gets a little bit crazier because he has to spin the nut. He's like, no, don't put that. And then he goes through another 100 years of not deathless sleep.
And Lee Pace puts on 30 pounds of fat at the end of every season. I want to see sloth Lee Pace. I want to see... Yeah. That guy, you know, Fat Thor,
levels depressed, of Lee Pace. just drinking Pabst Blue Ribbon on the throne, day and dusk, both aghast.
Yeah, show me that Lee Pace. I know he can work out a lot. I've seen him do it. Can he pack on the pounds in another way, though?
Yeah, you can sculpt that body. Can you deface it, Lee? That's what we want to know.
you know, I bet they're thinking that, too. I bet they're going to have a lot of fun with the various versions of Brother Day.
Yeah, I am curious, because like, I wonder when the next flash forward will be, because we went through a couple of dynasties last year too, so it could be that we go through a few this one too. I'm looking forward to seeing where this mystery leads. Lots of names. This Hober guy, we got the Rios guy. There's going to be a lot of people we're going to be meeting in the next few weeks. Are going to be important, and I can't wait.
I just want to say there's also a pretty good chance that Lee Pace will be down for that. Did you know, I was listening to the official cast, and David Goyer was saying that they wrote the scene at the beginning of episode one, the fight scene with the assassins, where Lee Pace was in a robe the entire time, and Lee came up to him and said, do you mind if I do this scene naked? I think it would be.
Out.
I think it would be
no,
better.
No, no, no.
Yeah, and David said, "I was hoping you would say that because I was secretly thinking it."
Got to putty up your belly button, but sure. No, yeah.
So
yeah,
I could. Man, Lee Pace will be down for it. Whatever they do with him, that'll be cool.
Do you mind if I just do this naked? Can I just do all the scenes naked? They probably just kind of work better.
Yeah, the fourth time he asked that about a scene, David was like, no, we really need you to wear clothes this scene.
Yeah.
Lee, come on.
It's important. We're running out of putty. We're running out of putty in the belly button budget.
Yeah.
The all-important triple B below the line item. You got to watch those. Is there anything else we want to talk about? Get hyped for episode 3. What do you have to say? We would like to know. Send that feedback into foundation@baldmove.com. You're listening to Foundation and Podcast. We'll be right back. We're about 10 weeks out from House of the Dragon Season 2, and it's time to prepare for war.
Which in our case means, watching a lot of Hot D and reading a lot of Fire and Blood.
Each week between now and June 16th, Maester Anthony and his co-host Steve are hosting a watch of each episode of Hot D Season 1. And then me and Jim are going to host a discussion of the differences between the events on that episode and how they're recounted in George R.R. Martin's historical tome, Fire and Blood.
That's right, I've resorted to reading dragon books. God help us all. We'll see if my fresh eyes add any new insights or predictions into Season 2.
Arm yourselves with all the lore you can for the battles ahead. House of the Dragon returns June 16th, but we've got you covered until then.
Check out all of our upcoming Hot D coverage on the Hot D feed or on Bald Move Pulp, available wherever you listen to podcasts.
Mm-hmm.
Since the dawn of time, we've been putting clothes on our back that identify us with our people, our group, our tribe.
And while Bald Move might be one of the smallest, weirdest tribes out there, transcending all concepts of border, class, culture, and creed, we still have respect for the old ways.
At support.baldmove.com, you can get t-shirts, hats, mugs, and more. We have something for every one of our podcasts, or just wear the four pips of the Bald Move logo with pride.
Bald Move merch beats running around naked, and they make a great gift for the Bald Move fan in your life. Join our tribe! Head over to support.baldmove.com and click on merch to start shopping. And we're back. Respect and enjoy the podcast. We do have feedback for this week. First up is Eric. He says, I was wondering about the technological advancements. My question is, do you think that 134 years of cryo-freeze would basically render you useless due to how far you would advance? Are technological advancements going to keep at the same rate they do today, or will they level off eventually? Imagine taking someone from 10 BC and putting them in the year 1900. I don't think it would be that big of a shock, besides maybe the sheer size of structures that were built. And will still power most farm equipment and transportation. Local businesses is where you get most things you need to survive. Not that big of a change, but take someone from 1900 and put them in 2023, it'd be unrecognizable. So 134 years past their current year, would the advancements be that exponential? Jim, you got a feeling about the level of technological progress in the Foundation universe?
I mean, it's a good question. It's tough for me to tell in this show because so much of the technology we see at the beginning of the show seems like magic to me that it's hard to tell where, you know, what tech they have now 130 something years later that they couldn't have mustered at the beginning of the show. Mm-hmm. Right? Could they have built the rings around Trantor? Probably. I mean, they had a fancy space elevator, so maybe, but like, yeah, it becomes harder for me to tell because everything seems a little magical.
My take on it is like, this is something in Star Wars where it's like you get to a period of technological advancement where things start to slow down. Like, you know, hyperdrive was invented 10,000 years ago in the Old Republic, and hyperdrive is still used 10,000 years later. And it, you know, maybe it's a little bit faster, a little bit more reliable, but like I have a feeling that if you took a hyperdrive from 1,000 years ago and you put Han and Chewie in front of it, they would be able to figure it out in much the same way that, like, you used an example from 1900 to 2023. I think that's a pretty extreme example, but like I'm very convinced you could go back to 2000 BC, grab a couple of laborers from Egypt and put them on like 1080 era Roman aqueduct and say, go to work, boys. And they would instantly, or within, you know, again, you'd have to have the whole ancient Egyptian language thing. But if you could explain to them the concepts, they would quickly be able to grasp what they were doing and how they need to do it and start using their build. But you take the same, you know, you take a locomotive operator from 1890s and you put him in a nuclear reactor and be like, hey, this is essentially a steam boiler. He would have no fucking clue what even principles are at work powering the device, let alone how to, like, make it make energy.
Yeah, and I think that's the core of the question here is, have we so fundamentally mastered all the concepts of, you know, the laws of physics that the advancements don't come as fast at some point, or is it forever this snowball that just keeps picking up speed and mass?
I always think it's got to be the former, because eventually, like, if you got all the fundamental forces of the universe, yeah, you got them on equations and you know them forward and backward and you can solve for X, that's kind of what drives innovation, it seems to me. You know, and like we are living in a couple of 100 years of extremely fast progress, but like that will have to slow, because I think in universe, like Invictus, they describe that as an ancient, like being from hundreds, maybe even pre-Cleonic dynasty. And obviously the engineers at on a border world are able to fix that thing up and copy it. I think that shows the level of like what we call a technological stagnation. That's like
the Egyptian being able to work on a Roman aqueduct despite being 3,000 years apart in time, you know? Right.
Yeah, so you have some levels that you hit, then you plateau for a while, and then some discovery is made about fundamental core principles, and then boom, there's another explosion of development.
I'd even think like maybe like from an art or culture perspective, you might see very dated in terms of like the way you speak, but like it's interesting that you've got this Cleonic dynasty maybe putting the brakes on that kind of advancement, that like you've got a particular taste that is molding things and influencing things, and it's like these guys are dressed the same and they have everything. I wonder if that's like that, like everything in the galaxy is stagnating. That's one of the things that Harry Seldon was talking about, like, you know, if you want to slow down the decline of the empire, fucking get rid of your genetic dynasty. So this has been the case in a lot of different science fiction worlds. The idea that technology will get to a point where it's so good and people have so mastered the underlying levels that it becomes commodified and just kind of state, you know, like once you can travel 3,000 times fast the speed of light, you know, it's not like next year you'll travel 6,000. It's going to be, you know, 3,001, 3,002, and it'll take 50, 60 years to get those efficiencies, right?
And in Star Wars, it was droids the level of C-3PO and R2-D2. Can barely trundle across a desert.
Right, and they're just going to stay there for thousands of years.
Yep.
So I hope that answers your question, Eric. I think it's an interesting one. Rebecca says, I'm just getting caught up with Foundation Season 1 and have a couple of observations. The name of the ship Invictus seems to be an homage to the poem Invictus by William Ernest Henley. Part of which reads, it matters not how straight the gate, how charged with punishment the scroll. I am master of my fate. I am the captain of my soul. The religious manifestations of the mother, the crone, etc., that echo the religions of Game of Thrones. And I also see echoes of Antigone and Greek tragedy and empire in a speech at the end about the branch that will bend but won't not break. Or that won't bend will break. Wow, the won't bend will break. Haman tells Creon, pretty close to Cleon, right, that the tree won't bend, it will be ripped up by the roots and all, bend or break. I appreciate seeing that these writers are well-educated, and it underscores that we're getting really good storytelling. Yeah, I think that it is self-evident if you've looked at, you know, the Foundation, and, you know, I know David Goyer is not the only person in the writing's room, but, like, you look at his history of work, there's... Seems like they're extremely well read, and you know, I don't think
literary sensibilities.
I don't think these things are an accident, and I think they're taking what is a good framework of Asimov's tale and updating it in very smart ways. And yeah, we're getting all that on the screen, so I couldn't agree more, Rebecca.
This marriage seems like maybe the attempt to bend, but you know, the roots are coming up. So the bending doesn't really help.
Right. And as far as breaking, we know that's Demerzel's domain. So Al says, I am the only person I know that watches this show. I don't have many people to talk about bonkers science fiction concepts that are often showcased in Foundation. I was wondering if you could discuss how you would describe Foundation to friends that could become potential viewers. The best I've come up with is Game of Thrones in space, but I feel even this is very surface level and not a great description. It's the perfect description for The Expanse, but I agree it's not quite it for Foundation.
That's part of what Foundation is doing, because it loves that, you know, microcosm of drama there within the Cleonic dynasty, but there's so much more.
Intrigues and
It's tough. It's always been tough to describe even what Asimov's work on this was, even those books. I think the closest we can get is like the characters are not the people in it, but the societies. And those are the things you should be looking to for the dramatic effect that most shows go with for a single character.
Yeah, I feel like that the pitch of this show, which is in the far future, a man discovers a mathematical principle that can perfectly predict human behavior and says that the Galactic Empire that's lasted for 10,000 years is going to fall essentially tomorrow. And the only way to reduce the harm is to follow my very convoluted plan to usher mankind through this dark age. That's it, man. Like, you're either like hooked by that and fascinated by it, or you're not. And I think the problem is just a lot of people aren't. There's, you know, I've got a friend, he's a very dear friend of mine, and I love talking to him about shit like Breaking Bad. I love talking to him about stuff like The Wire. But like anything that he quote unquote requires him using his imagination, he just doesn't care about. And you know, he's like, I just think the world is already fascinating enough with all the stories you can tell within it that like the second that people start talking about dragons and magic and spaceships, I like, who the fuck cares? You know,
I feel him. I know, have one less objection, sense. Right? With the sci-fi stuff. I allow for that, but.
Because it's all about relatability. It's like the same reason, like, you know, people are always surprised, like, why I didn't like Succession. It's like, I just can't relate. I just like, because I start becoming aware of the, I just like, just go to fucking therapy, you asshole. Who cares what takes over? You're all going to be so richer than any pharaoh that I've ever read about. So
your problems are so far removed from my problems that I cannot understand why you are freaking out about them.
So I get it if you're talking about cloned emperors and people using the Force. So like, that's like, yeah, the exact same thing. It's like, this is so far removed from my day-to-day experience. But like, so like, yeah, if you're not into science fiction fantasy, it's a hard sell. But like that idea of like, what if you could predict history and you have to just take it on this word of this crazy guy that this is the way to go. And like, the other thing is like, you know, like if you're a thinking person, you start thinking, oh my God, like, you know, how would society work and how would they take that and how would the government take that? And like, there's like, that's the shit that I'm really interested in. That's a drama I'm really interested in, you know?
Yeah.
The fact that we get this juicy Kleonic stuff is a bonus. You know, the fact that they have spent so much time and effort on how you can make relatable antagonists kind of like span hundreds of years. Cause that's the other thing, I guess, is when to go back to the pitch, I'd say, and the story is going to take place over the course of hundreds, if not thousands of years. Like, just how do you tell a story like that?
Yeah, that makes me nervous as a reader. Cause like or a watcher, cause I want to connect with people in this story, and I don't see a way to do that in a story that spans longer than human lifetimes, significantly longer than human lifetimes. Yeah. So I get a little nervous when I hear that, but I think they're doing a good job. And also that's why I'm trying to like say the characters are not necessarily the thing to watch here. The drama comes from the bigger picture stuff, and it's such a huge swing. It's unlike anything else that you're going to read in that regard.
Yeah. Yeah, but that's the thing. If like they're not into that science fiction fantasy aspect, then the other stuff is just not going to hook. You know, the fact that this, like, you could tell, I'm like, oh, this is, you know, the roots of this go back to, you know, Asimov's Foundation series. You know, if you like Star Wars or Dune or Warhammer, anything with a galactic empire, this is the thing that this is the first guy to thought up that concept. You know,
yeah.
So there's a lot of reasons to recommend it, but like the core thing is like you just might not have enough nerds in your life, Al. In which case, you need to go find some more nerds, or you know, we'll be your nerd friends week to week. Watch the Foundation. I mean, that's all. That's why our jobs actually work. So, but I feel you. It's a tough one to, because like, you know, the Expanse is Game of Thrones in space. That's an easy pitch, but also it's a little bit more relatable because it's so close to us. A lot of the same thing, like we're recognizably human desires and thoughts and foibles, whereas, you know, Foundation, it's still that, but also you know, it's the foibles of a clone, of a 16th generation clone, you know,
right?
Those are still human, they're still foibly for sure, but relatable. Ooh, this is a good question. Nick from Philly. First off, he says, during your preview pod for Foundation last week, Jim stated how visually amazing season one was. It took only 5 minutes for the show to blow me away. The sex/melee battle scene with Cleon, absolutely amazing visually and amazingly well choreographed as well. I'm so fucking in with this show. Apple definitely knows how to do sci-fi. Triple exclamation mark on that, but I think it's warranted because, yes, Apple TV has become the sci-fi aficionados. Haven and home. Like, it's got all the best stuff, it feels like.
I think there was a minute where HBO and Netflix were trying to do that, but they didn't do it as successfully, in my opinion, as Apple has done it. They've got like four or five shows that are just killing it. I mean, For All Mankind, Foundation, Severance.
Yeah. Yeah. And those are just the big ones we're talking about. Silo
now. Yeah.
Where like, you know, Amazon, when they got The Expanse, I thought they would be the ones that are going to do the big sci-fi stuff, but they just, you know, they do sci-fi fantasy, but, yeah, mm-hmm. like Apple's, it seems like that's what one of the things they're specializing in. My question for you is this: if you guys were forced to live in the Foundation universe, would you be Foundation or an Empire sympathizer?
Ooh. Probably be neither. Probably be somebody who's trying to live their life and just being like, hey, leave me alone, Empire. I got my own thoughts and opinions on things. I don't need you butting in. But I don't think I would necessarily be down with Foundation either. Because not many people know about Foundation. Like, am I being sent on... Am I a Seldon acolyte who's being sent to Terminus and... Now I have to choose a side, because I feel like once you go to Foundation, you've chosen your side, right?
Yeah.
I'd just be a dude. That's what I would
I think you're getting at is that it's like asking somebody if you would be on the wrong or right side of history, right? Or and the reality is if you're in the history, like you are such a... And this is something the show delves into. You are such a product of your genetics and the way you were raised, the information that you were fed, that like the reality is like, you know, it's like this is a question like if you were a German in 1930, yikes, would you have taken the stand against the growing like, and we all want to say we would. Mm-hmm. But the reality is the majority of us probably would have turned out like every other German where it's like, yeah, if you, you know, if you'd known more about this, you've been uncomfortable, but like also fuck those French people and the English. And, you know, it's like, it's your product of the environment you grow up in. And I imagine if I grew up in like the core of the empire, I would be, you know, addicted to the affluence and the, affluence and the influence. And I would protect my position, and anyone that would probably try to point out to the rougher things happen on the edge of the galaxy, I would be highly defensive and not want to take any, you know, acknowledgement that I have a role in those people's hardships, because that would make me feel bad. Just the same shit we do today, right? I mean, honestly,
yeah, I'd be on Twitter like throwing shade at Empire, but also I don't think I'd be all on board with Foundation either. I don't know.
Honestly, if you are on the internet and comprehending English in the year 2023, you probably are already tied to a hegemonic empire that's mm-hmm. done some bad shit that you probably live a remarkably conflict-free life and don't think much about that, exactly. Those aspects of it, right? Yeah. So it's like, what do you, you know, so I'm a person that's like, you know, I guess I try to be aware and speak about like, what am I really doing? What am I really doing mm-hmm. to make things better on a globe? So it's like, yeah, you'd probably be wherever you're at. You'd be well entrenched in that position and not much would be able to move you out of it.
I'm trying to taint the dynastic bloodline. That's what I'm doing in my spare time.
Yeah.
Yeah. Trying to get in there and just mess it all
genetically
up.
Or like through sexually. Okay.
Well, yeah. I mean, that's the only mechanism I have to taint it genetically.
Just walking through the pleasure gardens naked and just hoping something will happen, or
yeah, see anything you like.
Andy
they never
says,
do. They never do, and I don't understand why.
Yeah. That's your plan to bring them down, huh? Just put yourself out there.
Yep.
Andy says, hey guys, I wrote in near the end of last season to ask, how could Demerzel not be noticing the difference in Dawn from the very beginning, having raised them all before? My theory is that Demerzel was responsible for adulterating the Klingon line, and this season 2 opener has me more convinced than ever that Demerzel's behind all the nefarious attacks on the Empire. She has all the access. Perhaps it's all part of the original plan to upend this Empire after so many iterations, or maybe it was left for her to decide by Klingon the First. He's like, do me a solid of 400 years and end this shit gracefully if it gets out of hand or strays from our vision. Or maybe she made that decision on her own somewhere, perhaps when the Skybridge fell. It gnaws on me how completely convinced everyone is of Demerzel's allegiance, but if she's powerful as we were led to believe, how are these mini infiltrations occurring and continuing? She has to be in on it, all of it. Day says Demerzel initiated their entanglement. Not since Klingon 1 and this one is implementing a new order, too. I find it all shady as fuck. Jim, your thoughts?
This is super interesting. Especially given the idea that she wasn't created specifically for the task of keeping Empire going. She was kind of co-opted into it, right? She existed well before the Kleonic dynasty.
I think she existed before the fucking Galactic Empire.
Yeah.
I think that they
11,000 years old.
She is at least 1,000 years older. Maybe it was the Galactic Empire 8,000 or 10,000. But
it doesn't matter. She's older than it. Yeah.
Yeah. She's 4 digits older than the Galactic Empire. So you think she could have allegiances so ancient and so arcane that we don't even know. And the old, and then there is like, why are people so convinced? Because the people that know that she's a robot are under the impression that she is under this ironclad lock of these robotic rules that Asimov, and you know, they're not going to say this on the show because I literally think they don't have rights to it. But like, if you know anything about Asimov robotics, they have these laws that they've kind of sketched at the show. And they think that like Demerzel is incapable of breaking these. But if you've paid attention in season one, you can see where Demerzel is at the bending, if not breaking point, of a lot of her different rules. So like,
and
I think that's
an interpretation.
I think that's a false sense of confidence that they have. And I think one of the things we're going to appreciate is that, you know, but before all this is all said and done and over.
It's crazy that I haven't even considered that. And that it takes an email to make me think of like a fundamental question. I think is Demerzel as loyal as it seems? Cause I always took it for granted.
Yeah. And yeah. The show kind of like, you know, makes you think that way because like they always say that she's unquestionably loyal to the Empire. Like that's the one thing that no one ever questions. Like even in
but
this,
they say it. They
this
just
episode
say
where
it.
You
that
got
mean
Day,
true.
You got Day, you know, doubting all of his brothers and putting him through memory scans and scrutinizing his bride to be. Like no one ever thinks about Demerzel.
Yeah, and it's easy to point the finger at Dawn and say, "Well, he has the most to lose." But is that true? Maybe Demerzel has more to lose.
Honestly, the more I think about it, because I thought about a lot about like, you know, is Klingon respecting the agency of Demerzel and their sexual relationship? But you know, sometimes you forget about the fact of how old and ancient and powerful she is. And the fact that like, yeah, maybe in this, you know, like I think of it in terms of like, well, she can't disobey. She's effectively a slave, and the sex slave is even, you know, that's like that's another level of distaste beyond just regular slavery for most people. So it's like, oh, she's clearly the one down in this position, but is she?
Right. She can technically disobey. I mean, Day last season did not want her to kill the Dawn that had been, you know, corrupted. But she did.
Even if you're saying she's loyal to Empire, the capital E, that's three different people, sometimes three different competing desires and wishes. And...
Right, because Dusk wanted him killed. So
right. Right. And if Dust doesn't want to step into we've talked about what happened. So yeah, no, there's I mean that's what's so interesting about science fiction, because a lot of like if this was a conventional show, a lot of these answers would be, well, it's just it is what it is on the face of it. But like when you got 13,000 year old robots running around that have had who knows what life experiences, religious experiences, we found out last season. It gets a lot more interesting, which, you know, I find you know, makes all the other things you're trying to talk about land a lot better too. So yeah, a lot of people had a couple of feedbacks this week, you know, not sure why, but I'm feeling like there's something no good going on at Demerzel, which again,
I mean, look at the Empress, right? Like that.
Yeah.
That really threw me for a second.
Yeah. And we're saying she's up to no good. Like if just because she's maybe agitating against the Empress, that might be what a good person would do. Agitate against the Empire. So Cyrus says, I've not read any books. I have no advanced knowledge of the plot, but with Goyer playing jazz the story, it probably matters less. Nevertheless, I formulated two theories from the first two, or I'm sorry, from the first episode of the season. Theory the first. I wonder if Demerzel is going off what Harry said about the way the Klingons could slow down the impending darkness that he was predicting, and that was for the Klingons could put an end to the genetic dynasty. I wonder if she is behind Day's plan to marry and produce progeny the more conventional way, using her intimate relationship with him to push that agenda. Is Demerzel secretly working with Harry and the Foundation to slow down the upcoming darkness, or perhaps to give Foundation the time they need, or perhaps as a ploy to slow the end of the Empire based on what Harry has mentioned? What do you think about that? Do you think Demerzel is secretly working with Harry and the Foundation?
It's possible, but I'm trying to think, because Harry has not been alive long enough, I think, to influence her ultimate goal. He's not been alive as long as the Empire has been around. It seems like he does not have enough influence or contact within Empire to make that reality, but we don't know about the history of Demerzel enough to know.
I think it's interesting with Demerzel and the Foundation, as I understand it, is, you know, psychohistory predicts human behavior. Mm-hmm. If you do have a cybernetic organism that is secretly manipulating things at the very top, mm-hmm. did he account for that?
Right.
Is this another
Can
thing?
Psychohistory predict that?
Like Gale's psychic premonitions that are going to be a wrench in his plan going forward.
It's possible.
It also could be that, like, they're not working directly together, but Demerzel's a thinking, feeling being of her own. She could take a look at the psychohistory and decided for herself that, like, well, maybe there's something to this, and I need, you know, because the zeroth law of robotics is that a robot cannot, by its action or interaction, threaten the security of the human species at large, you know, human civilization. So she might interpret it as a zeroth law to not go along with the, even though the Harry's not aware of her cooperation. Mm-hmm. And again, to the extent that he was aware or not aware, like, that's interesting to see how that plays back into the Prime Radiant too, his calculations.
Yeah, and psychohistory, you know, is a tool of a very short-lived being to try to extrapolate on the future, whereas Demerzel's 11,000 years old. She's seen much shit. She has lived history for the last 11,000 years. She might not need psychohistory as a tool, just her own accumulated knowledge and understanding of humanity to kind of see that, oh yeah, the downfall is inevitable and we can sort of usher in something new.
Second theory, Harry and the Radiant may not care about the Foundation on Terminus. From last season, we knew that his conversation with Gale, that he was going to begin a second Foundation in secret on Helicon. This is the Harry that Gale trapped in Radiant. Maybe Harry's plan was to always have the Foundation on Terminus be out in the open and incur the wrath of the Empire. He thought the Empire's attack on the Foundation was inevitable. The friends of the Foundation on Terminus would rally to the cause of Harry when they find the existence of a secret Foundation on Helicon, at which point the Foundation would be too powerful to be stopped by Empire. If true, Harry and the Prime Radiant may not care about the fate of the people on Terminus, which may be in opposition from the goals of Gale and Salvor. Could we have a Harry from the Vault versus Harry from the Radiant situation? I think, kind of like reveals that some of this stuff is, you know, like he clearly sees the first Foundation as a sacrificial lightning rod or anode.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a good comparison.
And that all the people are not, you know, like, and all the people in the plot are not very important to him. Like, he is looking at big picture things.
Yeah.
I do like the idea. We played with this in the podcast ourselves. The idea that you've got two different Harrys that might be diametrically opposed. Because the other thing is, like, do you tell the Harry? I guess the Harry in the Vault has to know the plan. He has to.
Yeah, yeah, because the second Harry spawned off of the first Harry, so.
Now that I think about it, could I buy that Harry? Well, the Harry, yeah, you're, well, okay. Yeah, because the Harry on Terminus is literally made from his body, presumably his incorporating his thoughts.
Uh-huh.
And the Terminus, the Harry that's on the second Foundation, was an incomplete backup from Harry at the moment of his death. So, yeah, I guess if it turns out later that one of them doesn't know something the other one does, I would hope that they explain that somehow.
Mm-hmm.
Because otherwise, at the point of their departure, they should essentially... Maybe you would argue that the Harry the Vault wouldn't even know more. Like, at most, he would have a little bit more complete knowledge of his death.
Okay, maybe.
I don't think any of the Harrys could have secrets from each other when they went into their respective containers. Now, afterwards, there's all kinds of times adrift, but I think they went into their substrate of one purpose.
Yeah, so the Harry in the Vault must know about the Second Foundation, is what you're getting at, right?
But he's trusting himself not to reveal that to the First Foundation.
Yeah, but then you've got the complication of both Harrys could be insane because of time spent.
True.
Because of the time scales we're dealing with and the nature of their being now.
Or they just changed their minds, you know? Like, new shit comes to light.
Saw it isn't going well.
Yeah.
We gotta just cancel. Abort the mission.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of places they could take the story. I'm kind of curious to see which way. We'll go.
Yeah.
That's going to wrap up for feedback this week, which will bring our episode to a close. Once again, that's foundation@baldmove.com. That's how you get all your feedback in to us for consideration. We can be followed at damn near every social media at Bald Move. TikTok is the stubborn one. We're Baldest Move there. The other thing you can do is support us at support.baldmove.com. It's not just good feelings. You don't just get the good feelings of keeping us podcasting, but you get ad-free feeds. Bonus episodes of podcasts, Off the Clock, where we talk about a bunch of TV and movies and we're not talking about on our main podcast, Lunch with Jim and Aaron, tons of extra bonus features. Check that out at support.baldmove.com. That's going to do it this week for us here at Foundation and Podcast. Until next week, I'm your host, Aaron.
And I'm Jim.
Respect and enjoy the podcast.